Please listen carefully.
And now, live from the Arboretum in McKinney, Texas, it's the Assuming Positions Podcast, featuring two droids that someone's probably looking for, Kevin and Mikey.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Assuming Positions Podcast. Kevin over here.
And Mikey over here.
And we are back in the studio with some fun things to talk. Okay, so we've talked a little bit about this before in Nerd Alerts.
Yes.
And this series isn't over yet, but an episode came out. Well, a couple episodes of it came out, and our heads were spinning around.
Mm-hmm.
Exorcist style. Oh, no, that's too dark, but you know.
Spinning on a pivot.
And we were like, we need to talk about this right now. So we're going to talk about it right now, even though there might be two more episodes that come out that are even have even more revelations in it. But what we're talking about is on Disney Plus, there's a series oddly named Disney Gallery.
Disney Gallery, yep.
And right now, it's all a little docuseries about the Mandalorian show, television show.
Exactly. For all the people that are complaining about there's nothing on Disney Plus, it's just all old reruns. This is, they're adding more content, and some of it's going into this Disney Gallery series. So,
yeah. So, I don't know. And did you know anything about what the Disney Gallery is supposed to be? Is it going to have all kinds of Disney stuff?
I have no history of this. It looks like, I guess this is their platform for old behind the scenes or sort of extra surplus material to what they're doing with Disney.
Mm.
But this is new to me.
It's like 30 for 30.
Yeah.
But Disney.
Yeah. Inside baseball, but inside nerd.
Disney's 30 for 30.
I like it.
All right. Wonder how nerdy our audience is. If they're here, they're like, what's 30 for 30? 30 for 30 is an ESPN.
Yep.
It was supposed to be like, they were like 30 minute documentaries, I think,
yep,
they initially had done.
Mm-hmm.
But now there's more than 30 of them, so I don't know, but it's still called 30 for 30.
That's just their label.
And they're just little documentaries, like Mikey said, inside baseball, but and literally sometimes inside baseball. The most popular ones are inside basketball, it seems, but
yeah.
There's also the football. They just sports. ESPN. Sports.
But I will say, as a non-sports fan, 30 for 30 is some of the best material just because it goes so deep and gives you such a behind-the-scenes picture. And then how this translates to Disney is the same amount. Like, you can maybe enjoy Mandalorian or Star Wars and just have a peripheral interest in it. But watching this behind-the-scenes documentary is just eye-opening, just how much is going on that you don't see.
Right. And like we said, we've talked about it a little bit here and there in Nerd Alerts, and we've been talking about it in our friend groups. If I repeat myself at all, and you're like, I already heard Kevin talking about this, it's because I can't remember if what we had all talked about before and what we had talked about with my friends, because this has been rolling around in our nerd group, how amazing. First of all, we've said we think The Mandalorian's amazing. It's an amazing series. It's done so well, done so lovingly.
Yep.
And what's interesting is they come out with this docuseries showing behind the scenes, and then you can see the chefs, a bunch of grandmas in the kitchen lovingly making this wonderful meal for you. And you can see why it shows through. It pushes through all the way from the caring about it.
Yes.
Pushes all the way through to the screen to what you saw, what we saw as nerds.
This is how grandma makes it taste so good.
Yeah.
No, I'm with you, because we have talked about it a little bit. I think in our Nerd Alerts, we talked about episode one, but the cool thing about Disney Gallery is they're doing that slow release thing where they're not putting just the whole series out at once. It is a timed release thing that a lot of shows are doing. So we're talking about it now when episode six has gone up on Disney Gallery. I think there's going to be 8 total episodes for The Mandalorian, and then we'll see how they continue it in the future, but it is just sort of a... It's not an immediate binge thing. They're releasing it in parts. So
yeah, I don't know what's left to show after the sixth one, but
that's exciting.
Yeah, it's exciting. We'll see.
Because they've shown so much cool stuff already up front that anything that can happen in their 7th and 8th release will be, if they can top it, it's going to be awesome.
Yeah, and I remember on the Nerd Alerts, we kind of laid into how Dave Filoni is the Padawan of George Lucas.
100%.
And it shows through, it bleeds through. He's a nerd in charge. Jon Favreau is the big nerd in charge, but Filoni, like we said, I went ahead and rewatched that first episode, and it literally starts with Filoni giggling.
Yeah, yeah.
Over seeing, being able to see the laser in the reflection of his helmet, and then laughing at himself for being so nerdy that he giggled about it. So self-aware nerddom is really...
I have to agree with you. Dave Filoni, one, is responsible for all the Star Wars that we love in Mandalorian and the Clone Wars cartoon right now. The reason it's so good is because of Dave Filoni.
Mm-hmm.
But my favorite part currently about Dave Filoni in this Disney Gallery series is he seems like he's one of us just that happens to get the chance to sit in with all these like Hollywood mucky mucks. And he laughs and he enjoys it every single time. Uh-huh. It's never just like, oh yeah, I should be here. He's like, that's you, and you're famous, and you're talking. Or we're talking about Star Wars, and I love it. Dave Filoni is all of us sitting at this round table at Disney Gallery just because he's like, yeah, and remember when George Lucas said this? And
100%, because some of the people, like you got John Knoll and a lot of these visual effects guys,
yep,
who've been with Lucasfilm since even before the prequels,
mm-hmm,
and worked on the prequels and stuff. And those guys are so, like, business as usual, kind of. You know, I mean, they also worked with George Lucas closely and everything.
Yep.
But they're, like, so business as usual, and they come across as technical and professional. And I'm not trying to diminish any of this stuff. I'm not saying they don't love their job and everything. But what I'm saying is...
I got you.
There's the difference. You can see the Hollywood professional, and then... And I'm not calling Dave Filoni not professional, but Dave Filoni is like sitting there in his cowboy hat with his Mandalorian t-shirt on, you know, like he won a special pass,
yeah,
at the convention to go back there, you know, win a pass for a roundtable with Jon Favreau, Kathleen Kennedy, John Knoll.
Yeah. You get to sit there, hang out, and geek out, but don't say anything.
But he does say, and the funny thing is that when he starts going into... the sage of Star Wars, when he starts speaking about Star Wars, everyone like shuts up.
Yeah.
And like, is like, what Dave's talking? You know what I mean? And like, seriously, Jon Favreau, one of the most powerful guys in Hollywood.
Yep.
Just sits there and he shuts up and he's looking at me. He's got this smile on his face, like a proud dad kind of, in a way.
I get it.
You know? And then you look over and you see Bryce Dallas Howard going like, I can't believe this is a real human. He's amazing. You know, the shots and everything.
Yes.
You know? And you can tell Taika Waititi wants to give him a hug. He has like this just joy oozing out of him.
He has the nerd joy. And yeah, I think that everybody recognizes that he's the soft, vulnerable nerd that everybody wants to protect. Like, the friends that you have that are soft, vulnerable nerds, protect them. But we talked about episode one, which is all the directors that we're mentioning. It's mm-hmm. Bryce Dallas Howard, it's Deborah Chow, it's Fakima, it's all those. But Dave Filoni really speaks up in episode two when we're talking about legacy, and that's what you're talking about, where he starts saying, hey, I worked with George Lucas, and he had all these ideals, and here's sort of the mythology behind it. And just to hear... not only his joy, but the fact that there was so much thought put into, like, the meaning behind everything,
right,
is fascinating.
I mean, he spends, like, the end of the episode is, like, 5 minutes.
Yes.
And if you watch that 5 minutes and then still come away going, like, prequels were crap,
well,
you just go away. Because after hearing him go through with that and explaining... like, it was very strange. It was almost like you go to church and then someone actually explains to you, you know, what this scripture was trying to say. And you're like, oh, where do I donate my tithes to? You know, but that's what it was like. He was
absolutely
like, this was what George was trying to do.
Yes.
And he talks about how, like, he's like, Qui-Gon was a Jedi who realized that the other Jedi were doing it wrong and they'd become corrupted.
Mm-hmm.
And Jedi are supposed to care and they are supposed to love.
Mm-hmm.
And he realized that Anakin needed a father. And he's like, but then there's the fight. And he talks about like the fight with Darth Maul. He goes, you realize it was called, he didn't say you realize this, but he's like, it was called Duel of the Fates because they were fighting over the fate of Anakin Skywalker. And I'm like, that's why it was called Duel of the Fates? Wait, he knew what he was doing. The thing is, you go like, he knew what he was doing.
It all clicks.
And then he explains, like, Jar Jar is supposed to be useless.
Yep.
So that Obi-Wan can compare this little slave kid to Jar Jar to show how hard Obi-Wan's heart is.
Yes.
Towards a child.
Mm-hmm.
this little toe-headed child. But because he's like totally bought into the Jedi Order, Obi-Wan has.
Yes.
And the Jedi Order has become hard-hearted.
Mm-hmm.
But there's cracks in there because Obi-Wan is the Padawan of Qui-Gon.
And Anakin's all like trying to shake things up, like right. trying to expose those right. cracks. Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, and then just like he's like, Anakin needed a father, but he was given a brother. And so you're like, what? And he just explains, like, and then he's like, everyone thinks Anakin should have been a piece of crap. He goes, but this is why he should have. And he's like, you know, and everyone thinks Luke was all good. He goes, Luke was really trying to, considering the dark. He explains, like, and he's like, from the prequels all the way till Return of the Jedi,
mm-hmm.
there's a whole overarching story arc.
Yep.
And then he rolls it up at the end. Where he's like, George Lucas, he said, no matter what you're working on, make sure it's hopeful. Because kids need hope.
That's right.
And it's all, he said, Star Wars is all about selfless actions.
I believe it.
And it's like, what? And it just, it makes you go like, oh, wow, with this Star Wars is in such good hands.
Mm-hmm.
But it also makes you like, man, I wish that they had elevated Filoni earlier. Because... would some of the warts that people have with the sequels
mm-hmm.
not be there?
Yes.
I think yes. I think the answer is yes.
He would have smoothed out some of the corners is what you were saying?
Yes.
I believe it.
I think he would have. Because as much as I love J.J. Abrams and as much as I think J.J. Abrams got it,
mm-hmm.
J.J. Abrams doesn't have it as much as Dave Filoni has it.
Dave Filoni has the devout love of the Church of Star Wars
yes.
behind him.
Yeah. Right. Whereas J.J. Abrams has his own, he's got his own ideas.
As he should. He's a director. Yeah. He's the guy in charge. Yep.
Created his own things, and it's fine. Everything's fine. But also, too, I think that part of the issue with that whole thing, if we want to talk about the sequels for a second, I think part of that issue was that whole thing was the clunkiness of them. With the Mandalorian series, the multiple director thing seems to work really well.
I gotcha.
But the reason why it worked well is because if you see a lot of behind-the-scenes stuff, all of them are there at the same time at certain points.
And working within the same framework, yeah.
Yeah, with Jon Favreau.
Exactly.
And they're all there together at certain points. Not just in the round table. I'm saying they're showing behind-the-scenes stuff where all of them are there.
Yeah, like together. A team. Yeah.
So there's this vision, and whereas... with the movies, they're like, okay, JJ's going to get this run, and then we're going to find someone else for the next one,
yep.
and then we're going to find someone else for the third one. I think the idea is they're trying to do that because the first three were three different directors. I don't know. But it really, but in my mind, either have the three directors on board from the jump,
mm-hmm.
or just let JJ do all three of them.
Yeah.
And I know part of it was that JJ didn't want to do all three of them. But J.J. loved Star Wars so much that I think that if you were like, okay, then you don't get to do any of them. He probably would have been like, okay, I'll do all three of them.
I get you.
But, I mean, that's just, a lot of this was, I think, Disney/Lucasfilm growing pains. It was like, we own you now, Lucasfilm, make new Star Wars right now.
And, I get you.
And then it wasn't as well thought out as, hey, we need to make this Star Wars TV show. I think part of the problem was, in my mind...
Mm-hmm.
And seeing how well this was done, how well thought out this was, is in part because Jon Favreau's a genius.
Well, yeah.
And we talked about that in one of our other episode about how he's like Nick Fury, where he knows how to assemble the
yeah,
Avengers of Star Wars, you know what I mean?
Yeah, recruit all the superheroes yeah. to get the job done.
And the right superheroes yes. to get the job done.
Mm-hmm.
So we can see how he's that genius. But at the same time, it seems like there was a lot of, he was kind of given that to Lucasfilm because they're like, Star Wars has never been done in a TV format before other than animation.
Yep.
Which made his genius go, well, let's get the guy who's done the animation. Freaking genius, Jon Favreau. But also, too, I think that they were being careful because they didn't want to mess it up as far as this is the first Star Wars live action TV show. We can't mess this up. We have to get this right.
I get it.
And they talk about that in the Legacy series episode mm-hmm. of the gallery series. And with this, the movies, I think... they had a little bit of that, but I think they had a lot of bit of, yeah, we know how to make movies.
Yeah, and we know what Star Wars is, so yeah. just like so, let's crank yeah. it out. Let's
exactly.
let's get it moving.
Right. I think they should have let it breathe a little bit more, maybe. Either let it breathe a little bit more or let JJ do all three of the stupid things.
Oh, I'm with you. Yeah, I get it.
Or
yeah.
let, even if it wasn't JJ, if you like The Last Jedi, I'm not trying to diminish The Last Jedi. If you like The Last Jedi, fine, then have Rian Johnson do all three
yeah,
of
yeah.
them. I'm just saying, one freaking vision, do all three of them.
And you're not saying it's one specific person, but like we're saying with this Disney Gallery Mandalorian series, have it be one consistent team that works through it.
Exactly. So like I said, if you wanted Rian Johnson to do the second one,
yes,
have him be there with JJ making the first one too.
Exactly.
Doing something or mm-hmm. just hanging around.
Yeah.
And whoever was going to do your third one, have them there too.
Exactly.
And developing it together so that you don't get the weird thing where you could tell they're kind of back and forth in each other. I don't think some people saw it as a, I don't like how you did it, JJ, so I'm changing it. And I don't like how you did it, Rian, so I'm changing it. I think it was more of a, well, I kind of want it to go this way, so I'm going to see how I can make it go this way.
Yeah.
And I think that's the wonkiness people are seeing. And that's the stuff that puts people on edge, and that's the stuff that people don't like. So
I'm 100% with you, because even though they had all these directors come in, there was, I think there's internet rumors that say, like, as far as the new trilogy goes, maybe with the prequels as well, but they had a plan from the start, and they sort of mapped it all out, and they still tried to fit it along the story that they had mapped out along the way, and then they were just fitting it in with different directors, which works. I mean, if you have a rough goal plan, but you are also bringing in different people's visions, and mm-hmm. so if and at different times. So if everybody's not on the same page or working as a team, it can get a little disjointed, and I can see where there can be problems with that. So,
and to talk about on the same page, we can talk about one of these episodes that talked about the technology and later on in the production stuff.
Ooh.
Is that pre-visualization thing that they were using.
Their previs, yeah.
Yeah, previs. Previs, what's previs? And apparently it's something they do in animation all the time, so Filoni knew about it.
Yep.
And Jon Favreau seemed to imply that it was kind of his idea to get that happening.
I would wager that's just Jon Favreau sort of slinging his Jon Favreau weight around and be like, I did this.
So no, I'm saying no. Jon yeah. Favreau was saying it was Dave Filoni's expertise in that.
I got you. Okay,
that led them to using previs. So previs is this interesting thing where they kind of use a video game. I guess they do it in video games too, and they do it in animation.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny because they were showing the previs footage.
Yep.
And it looks like a Xbox first generation video game, basically Xbox 360, maybe in some of them. But
yeah.
I mean, it definitely looked like
PS3, Xbox 360, GameCube, like yeah. Any older console could have rendered the software.
Yeah.
Yes.
So it's super simple, but it isn't too simple. I mean, it looked like the Mandalorian there and everything, but yep. And they do stuff that they put people in the suits and stuff to do like the fight scenes. Like they totally choreographed the fight scenes ahead of time.
Yep.
You know, and they're showing these guys in black suits like fighting each other on this tiny little soundstage. And you know, meanwhile, they're becoming the avatars in the previs.
Yes.
So basically, they had the episodes pretty much completely done in previs.
Beforehand, yeah.
Yeah, as far as the action stuff, really. It seemed like it was the action stuff, because I guess that's the hardest thing to block and figure out on a set.
Yeah. How many players are there? What your location is? That's the most high-intensity work, I believe it.
So the whole point of that is that enforces the point of what we were saying earlier, in that this was all planned out almost meticulously. And the reason why they had to do it for this, and it's in the lines there if you watch,
mm-hmm.
the reason why they do it for this as opposed to movies is because the shooting schedule for television is always way more compressed because the budget isn't as much.
Yes.
So they have to do as much beforehand as they can, because when the cameras go on and the mics get hot,
that's when the money starts spending.
That's when the money starts spending. So you don't want to take a lot of time. Whereas movies have way more time.
Yes.
And they were talking about how, I'm used to having 7 weeks for this type of thing, and yep. we only had 3 days.
Yeah.
So that's why they were doing the previz stuff, all the stuff ahead of time, using a video game engine and everything to do the animations for the action scenes and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But as a result of that, the directors have to be on board early. That stuff has to be thought about way ahead of time.
Yep.
And then that kind of accidentally solidifies the vision before you even start shooting it. So I think in the movies, I think a lot of the stuff in the movies was, like you said, they had points to hit.
Yes.
But figure it out along the way.
That was the cool thing about seeing that pool of directors, is that in the first couple episodes, it's the same round table. It's Taiki Waititi, it's Deborah Chow, like we're talking about. But all these people have come from like establishing themselves in the world of film, but they've all been brought in to do, I guess I'd have to look up who had done television beforehand, but
Deborah Chow had done a lot of television.
Okay.
She did Mr. Robot.
Mr. Robot, absolutely, yeah. Yes. And I think Bryce Dallas Howard has done a few episodes, but yeah. For the most part, most of them are big, like, film directors.
Mm-hmm.
So all of them were coming into this restrained timeline, less budget, sort of quicker schedules, mm-hmm. but because the vision had been set up so early beforehand, it wasn't really a hindrance to them. Like, they were all like, we know we're coming into this weird situation, but it's all been set up. There's massive technology behind it. There's massive storyboards and all that already set up and previs and everything that we can still do what we do in this shortened timeline. And just to get a peek behind that scenes is just fascinating.
Yeah, it was so neat. They were showing the storyboards too. So they're still doing storyboards. It's like storyboards plus previs.
And yep.
Previs is just kind of like high-tech storyboards, really.
Yeah, yeah.
So
animated storyboards almost.
Yeah, so that was cool too, seeing the storyboards and seeing the previs kind of mixed together with some scenes you'd seen before. It was really cool. And the neat thing too is most of these episodes, the later episodes, are about technology. So we'll talk about that a little bit before we talk, because they had directors and they had the cast, which we can talk about too. But while we're kind of on the technology stuff, they were talking to, I get all the visual effects guys mixed up.
Oh, yeah.
They're all great. Lucasfilm Visual Effects, we love you.
ILM, shout out to you, man. Even though we don't know your names, we love your product.
They were talking about that before this, that they had a project where they were taking the Star Wars, they were looking at the original three Star Wars movies and taking like the way that stop motion animation was done.
Yes.
And then recreating it in the computer so that Star Wars stuff would still look like Star Wars stuff digitally.
Yeah, yeah.
And they had that thing where they were showing the chicken walkers. I like calling them chicken walkers. I know they're AT-STs, but when they were showing the chicken walkers on Endor.
Yes.
And then they had like right next to it a CGI one, like walking with the exact same motions.
Trying
to match what the old stuff did, because that's what Star Wars, quote unquote, looks like.
Yes.
And they were talking, they had this whole episode where they were talking about what Star Wars looks like and mm-hmm. how they used that to inform how they did this show.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if they did that in the movies, but whatever. But they did it in this show, and it worked great, because they were talking about how the models, they were limited by how big the models were, how big the room was, how far the track was for the camera to move around it. And how they like did a thing to, they added motion by moving the star field.
Yes.
Which wouldn't actually see that if you were really doing it. That's like a Star Wars thing.
It is.
But they actually put that in The Mandalorian, even though they didn't need to, and they don't really do it anymore. Like, if you're doing a modern sci-fi space thing,
mm-hmm.
you don't move the star field because it wouldn't move. But Star Wars did it back then to add the motion, add the dynamics, add that, whoa, this is fast, this is exciting.
Yes.
So it's brilliant that they knew enough and they had all that research done in Lucasfilm before to throw that in here and make sure that was in there, because that's what makes it, quote unquote, look like Star Wars.
Look like Star Wars, absolutely.
And that was kind of some of the knock on the prequels, actually, is that it didn't look like Star Wars.
But even still, even in this Disney Gallery expose, you get they do some clips of behind the scenes on the prequels,
mm-hmm.
and it's still all the same model practical effects. Like, yeah. You see the pod racer and somebody's manipulating it with their hand rather than doing it on a computer, and you go, oh yeah, they still did sort of the same thing, but...
I'm just saying that I've heard that didn't look like Star Wars. I disagree, because if George Lucas made it, then it looks like Star Wars.
And Dave Filoni will vouch for it in every one of these episodes. So yeah. You're like, I love it. I get you, Dave Filoni. Yeah.
But that's the thing, is that it softens your heart a little bit, because it's like, now George Lucas isn't making stuff in the Star Wars world. So it kind of like makes you appreciate the stuff he did make.
I get you.
Even if you were kind of like, of course, and then you talk to Dave Filoni and you're ready to like put a statue of George Lucas in your front yard.
Dave Filoni, for every time he speaks up about the lore and the magic of Star Wars, like you're saying, everybody shuts up and listens, because he has that captivation when he's talking about it, because it is so deep, and he's like the nerd representing all of us that are like, we love this, even though like some of this is wonky or this happened on screen, it doesn't matter, because this whole world exists, and Dave Filoni's a part of that, for sure. Yeah.
So there's another thing here in the technology thing that was making us go, what is happening right now? And it's funny because I don't think people realize how much Jon Favreau has been pushing special effects technology. Like, he's been involved in things that, like, The Jungle Book and
Lion King
and things like that.
Yeah.
He's been involved in it, but sometimes you don't know how much that involvement is on the technical side. Like, did you just hire, you know, this cool special, you know what I'm saying? Like, we know guys like James Cameron.
Yep.
And George Lucas, of course, but I'm saying, like, James Cameron, you know, he's a guy who is, like, super into pushing the technology, and he's got his fingers in it.
Exactly. Yeah, he pushed,
like, and then there's tons of other movies that come out that are, have lots of special effects, and the director's just directing it.
Yeah, and here's the new novelty.
And
yeah.
He really isn't super involved in pushing any technology or whatever. He's just trying to make a story, or she. but Jon Favreau seems like he is really involved in pushing this technology and what can we do and can we do this and how will this work, and he is so Nick Fury.
Avengers Assemble.
Yeah. So just, he's a great administrator, basically. He's like, okay, so I want to take all the stuff that I did in my previous things, Jungle Book and Lion King, and I want to use it for this.
Yes.
And we had some ideas then that we couldn't do that we might be able to do now.
Yes.
And one of the ideas is the craziest thing that we all want to go play in now, I think, is this thing called The Volume.
The Volume. That's such a weird name, but yes.
I know, it is a weird name, but it's a perfect name for what it is.
Yes.
And it is insane what it is.
It is insane.
It is a studio, well, with a soundstage. That's
soundstage,
what it's called. It's a soundstage that is surrounded by LED TVs.
And
that
an LED ceiling.
That are all interlocked together in like a dome of LED screens that project the entire set. It's basically like, it's like an old 1930s soundstage.
Yep.
But digital.
Yeah.
And on top of that, they're using the Unreal Engine technology that's used in Gears of War and Fortnite. They're using that technology to render the background as the camera moves around, as if the camera is an avatar in an online video game.
In real time.
Just like it does in Fortnite, yep. Just like it does in Red Dead, which we love. They use a different engine, but still.
same concept.
Same technology. And everything except for the, they call it the rail yard, which was outside. That was like where all the stormtroopers were and the TIE fighter came down.
Yeah, their B set or whatever. Yeah. Yep.
But everything else was done in The Volume. Stuff I thought was outside was not outside. Stuff you thought was outside was not outside.
True.
Stuff we thought was inside, but not the inside that we were seeing. I mean, it was crazy. It was so crazy seeing it from the angle of the camera wasn't. So everything was all winked out looking.
Yep.
And it made me want to be able to, like, move away from an avatar in a video game to see if that's what it would, I guess that's what it would look like if you, like, pulled away from your avatar.
Same sort of concept.
But it's so crazy because it fully surrounds them, so all the lighting is right.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why they were able to make the Mandalorian shiny, because he would be reflecting.
And he would be reflecting the light that they were casting on him in these made-up sceneries. I'm with you.
And the scenery was like real scenery.
Mm-hmm.
But they just rendered it in their own, they took a picture and then digitally rendered the picture.
Yes.
To put it in there. So they were real places. Mm-hmm. So that adds to the realism. And then they would have, like, I don't know if they were using real places so they could get the dirt from there, because they had dirt that matched that they would put on the floor, you know, that would go up to it. And they said that they would have a hard time if they were standing next to the camera. They would have a hard time telling where the set ended
and where the CGI began. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it was crazy, dude.
I guess that means they got some dirt from Tunisia, because...
Maybe, I don't know.
But there's two points. One, Jon Favreau, like you were saying, the fact that he's been sort of in this progression of this technology to sort of be the nerd that brings it to everybody, be like, hey, this is the project where we're going to perfect it. Like, I want to bring this in. I got a whole bunch of nerds with me. Let's blow it out and see how crazy we can get, because he definitely seems like that type. But then you see the behind the scenes in Disney Gallery of this thing called The Volume. Even when they're showing behind the scenes, you're like, wait, that's an LED screen? It looks just like it's the sunset with two suns on Tatooine, kind of like, this is a fantastic world and I'm already in it.
it's mind-blowing just even seeing it behind the scenes. And the way it translates into The Mandalorian just makes it A-plus entertainment that it is.
I know.
We're watching it right now.
And I don't know if so much of it must have to do with him having been an actor, too,
yeah. mm-hmm.
coming up. Because he's trying to address the problem that actors have with acting to, like, a tennis ball on a pole. You know what I mean?
In a green screen.
Everything,
of an empty,
yeah. Everything that Liam Neeson complained about. In acting in the prequels.
Yep.
That's where some of the derision from the prequels comes from, is because Liam Neeson was very outspoken on how hard it was for him to act when there was nothing there.
I believe it, yep.
And that's been, you hear that a lot from actors. They just, Sir Ian McKellen talks about it.
Yep.
And when he was doing Lord of the Rings, he hated it.
Yep.
Because when you're doing a stage play, even a minimalist stage play, there'll be like a table and a chair.
A prop to respond
something,
to. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Something to put you in the space. So what they've done here is they've made the space. They're in there. It's like being inside a video game. So you feel like you're there. And, I mean, we play online games, and,
yep.
and you feel like you're in there. And they feel like they're in there, too. And, I mean, one of the coolest things ever to me is that they have the cockpit of the Razor Crest there and with the stars all around it. And he's sitting there, and he's flying. And, like, the things that are there, the lasers are shooting past him. And the planet is actually, the planet starts coming up.
Over the horizon.
Over and from. And, what?
And you got Dave Filoni on a microphone that's like, all right, let's shift the stars left. Okay. Shift the stars right. Okay. And directing it in real time.
Yeah. I mean, crazy.
Oh, absolutely crazy. And then there's two factors that also play into that, which this series dives into. One, you have a stellar cast that's in this room that's conveying it. And two, I guess because of Dave Filoni, I'm going to attribute this to Dave Filoni because he's now my next Star Wars guru, but he's the one that seems to also be pushing that Star Wars, like we've said numerous times on the podcast, one of the fascinating part about Star Wars is that for as much as it's technology and CGI, it's always a mix of that with the practical and the human, with mm-hmm. the real world aspect. Mm-hmm. So whether that's the cast or the puppetry that's going on, which they talk about both in equal measure.
Oh, yeah, the puppetry's great.
Well, I think Jon Favreau is probably on board too, but everybody was in agreement that, like, Star Wars is a little bit a mix of both, and you have mm-hmm. to have both to make it work, and they did it, and oh.
I know, how about that? They wanted a Kwakian monkey lizard. So they're like, who did Salacious Crumb? And they're like,
Salacious Crumb.
And they're like, this guy did it. And they're like, can he build us another one and then come here and puppet it for us?
Yeah.
Okay. Like, they went and got the guy. Again.
The guy that did the original.
Nick Fury. You know, he hit his little Captain Marvel pager, but it was for Salacious B. Crumb puppeteer.
Well, I'm glad the guy that made Salacious R. Crumb didn't get snapped into dust in the timeline of the Avengers. So.
Yeah, that was crazy, too. And they did a whole big section. They call him the baby.
They do?
The baby. And that's one of my favorite parts. The biggest part that had, I mean, we'll talk more about the cast in a minute. But,
yes.
But they're talking to the cast here and there throughout the whole thing. There was a whole thing on the cast. But Werner Herzog, the longest he talked was about when he's talking about the baby. Do you remember? Like, that was like the most of him talking so far in the whole docuseries.
In the whole series,
was
yep.
him talking about the baby, and I was so giggling because of your impression you do of him.
One, I love Werner Herzog, but then also what precedes that scene is Deborah Chow's talking is like. Yeah, so I have Werner Herzog in my scene, and he's acting with Baby Yoda, or the baby, as they call him. But she says she had a problem in that Werner Herzog was directing the baby, like not realizing that it was puppeteers and a whole team of people. And he's just talking to the baby. He's like, you are the baby. I love your eyes and your ears, but you should emote a little bit more. You should turn your head. You should be more expressive, but I love you. I am captivated by you. It's phenomenal.
I know. She was saying he just totally. like, she's like, he's ignoring the fact that there's like puppeteers behind him. And there's
it took like, what, 4 or 5 people to make that puppet go?
It's a whole team.
Yeah. But yeah.
It was so
hilarious.
Believable that Werner Herzog fell for it. And he's like, this is the baby. It is a real entity. Yeah. I will act with it.
Yeah, Gina Carano said that everyone on the set would, like, kind of forget. and be like, and like Totlet, like, hey, baby, how are you today? Yeah. You know, and there's like a puppeteer in a blue screen suit, like, okay, hi.
But that's that magical mix of practical and CGI that we're talking about.
It took them, what, did they say, like 3 months to build that puppet?
They went through many, multiple sketches, multiple models, multiple maquettes. Like, yeah. it wasn't a one thing like, hey, this is Baby Yoda. No, like, they sort of refined it and proofed it and checked it out. And they nailed it because Baby Yoda is a phenomenon now.
But I think they said it took like 3 months to build, physically build.
I believe it. Because you have somebody working the ears. You have somebody working the eyes and mouth. You have somebody else working the hands. And then somebody else that actually has the hand inside the Baby Yoda and he's moving around the body. So it's a whole team of people.
And they're talking about how like they get all symbiotic together because the eyes guy has to make sure that he's gets there before the head does because people look before they turn their head and stuff.
It's true.
I'm like, wow, these guys are amazing. I am so glad that still exists today.
Oh, absolutely.
Because they could, as Werner Herzog said, they could have been cowards. You know? And just CGI'd the whole thing. And they even said that they had to go back to the CGI team and said, make it look like the puppet.
Yeah.
They said you were making it look too refined or whatever.
Yeah.
And they said, no, you have to make it more like the puppet.
Yeah, they limited the CGI saying, hey, if we're doing this in CGI, it can't do anything the puppet can't do.
Yeah.
And so just being aware of that limitation and consistency.
Oh, it's in such good hands.
But also, if your puppetry is so good as a team that you fool Werner Herzog, I think that's a thumbs up for your entire crew. Like, if he falls for it, that's good. In the practical episode, they do talk a whole bunch about Baby Yoda, which is great. He's the phenomenon of the series. But in that, they sort of glance over Quill, and Quill is an aspect of that episode. I don't know why it touched me, but there's a little person, Missy, in the costume.
Yeah, awesome is she?
She's wonderful. And even still, with her in the costume, they still had somebody doing eyebrows. They still had somebody doing the mouth. And it was still a team of people working to make this character. And then Nick Nolte is the voice. Yeah. I mean, so you have five people at least making one character, and it all comes out as seamless as Quill does.
Right.
I have spoken. Like, he's the undercard best character of the series.
I know, you're right. And they had Nick Nolte do five takes, they said, of each, and they would play it on the set to see which one fit best. Come on, man.
You think the ADR would come after the fact? No. He'd, like, Nick Nolte come in and just do some voiceover while this thing happens. Nope. No. It was all part of the process.
They're like, Dave Filoni's, they're like, okay, let's try three. I've spoken. Yeah, that's the one we're looking for.
And then they show behind the scenes a voiceover for Pedro Pascal. He's doing like the helmet voice. Well,
yeah,
that's another thing.
And he was holding a pillow for the
baby standing.
I mean,
so cool.
I mean, if you want to get into talking about the cast,
let's do it.
So that episode was great. And if you can watch that episode and then not fall madly in love with Gina Carano, I don't care if you're a male or a female.
I think it applies to both.
There's something wrong with you because she is one of the most delightful people. She seems like such a delight.
Exactly.
So happy to be there. So happy to be chosen.
Yes.
She seems like such a genuine person. And she can beat the loving crap out of you. It's that thing that Joe Rogan talks about. He talks about how some of these fighters are some of the sweetest people because they're so comfortable, because they're just like,
they have their arena where they get all out all their aggression and anger, and then outside of that,
right,
they're just like a teddy bear of a person.
Right.
I believe it.
Right. And that's what Gina Carano is, like this big pink teddy bear you just won at the fair that you want to snuggle with.
Because we've only heard of her, like, she had a career as a professional fighter,
mm-hmm.
doing wrestling and all that, and then she was in an action movie, Haywire, with Steven Soderbergh, so she is sort of that, like, Michelle Rodriguez just action chick. You just picture her to be kind of grumpy, get the job done, like, I can beat you up, I'm angry, you know, I got a point to prove, but she's a sweetheart. She has nice things to say about everybody. And is always smiling and gushing and be like, I'm happy to be here.
She's a great follow on Instagram, too. She is, because she's that person.
I believe it.
Positive stuff she's putting up there. And she just can't get over how loved she is by fans and stuff.
That's great. So,
yeah, it is great.
And then in the next to her, the standout for me, I guess I had never seen behind the scenes version of Carl Weathers.
Right.
I had seen Carl Weathers in everything. Like, he's been around for a minute. But I think in this Disney Gallery series is the first time I've ever heard him speak behind camera. Dude's a pro. Like, mm-hmm. when they're talking about actors, they defer to him because he's like, this is the actor's role, or here's the actor coming into it. And the way he describes everything is like, it's a master. It's like watching a professional work.
And they were talking about how much of a professional he was and how much of an actor's actor he is. And that's the thing is that, because Carl Weathers has done so much stuff. And like, when I was thinking about Carl Weathers, I think about the Arrested Development stuff that he did. Where we find out is the reason why he was so good in that is because he was playing a parody of himself,
mm-hmm.
but like a failed parody of himself.
Yes.
And that's the brilliance of that show, is because pretty much everyone's a parody of themselves in that show. I had no idea where he is, like, high level inside the actor's studio.
Yeah.
Professional actor, yeah.
Because, like, he's talking about the basic things we're all thinking about. Like, they're having to act with a Mandalorian who's a guy in a helmet who has no... You can't connect with his eyes. Like, he's a shiny guy that's reflecting all the light, which is what they made him for, but there's still some challenges there. Even going back to the Arrested Development Carl Weathers, you know that even though he was playing a parody with himself, he approaches it with, like, all right, what's the best process for me to get this job done because I am creating art, regardless mm-hmm. of what it is. And the fact that he brings that to the Mandalorian is just extra icing on the top. And it's just like, holy crap, you put so much... If the actors are putting so much thought into this, and the creative people are putting so much thought in this, and the directors... Everybody's on board, and it's just mm-hmm. Makes it the magical show that it is.
I also liked how Carl Weathers knows he's good and knows his confidence, because the part where they're like, they said, like, we're going to put him in a mask, but then we said, we can't put Carl Weathers in a mask. And he said, yeah, I figured that. And he was just kind of like, yeah. And I was like, yes. He almost has the Lando Calrissian attitude.
He really does.
Which is perfect for Star Wars.
Yeah. I'm here. You paid me to be here. Why are you gonna chance that up, baby?
Yeah. Oh, it was hilarious.
That also leads into the story. This was heartwarming to me. There's a little moment with Dave Filoni, who we were talking about, but they're talking about Carl Weathers coming in and trying to do makeup and their first establishment in the scene. And Dave Filoni openly admits and then tells a story about how, like, whatever he was doing just wasn't working. They had guys in, I guess, prototype costumes, especially for Carl Weathers and the Mandalorian, and everything was clunking and everything was awkward and weird. And he had a moment where he was like, this isn't going to work. I could animate this. Like, I could do this with my old skill set and get it done. I don't know how to do it in this new world. Mm-hmm. And it was just so heartwarming because, like, not only is he the stand-in for our every nerd in that round table being like, Star Wars is great, right? And everybody's like, yeah, Dave, Star Wars is great. He was out. It seems like he was out of his league and then just rose to the challenge.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, this is magical. I'm going to do what I can to get it done. And to hear that they had doubts on episode one of this series and that they didn't know how things were going to work. And then they pulled it off.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it's do it yourself, nerd. It's rise to the challenge and use your skill set to make something beautiful. It was extremely heartwarming. So shout out to that with Dave Filoni.
Yeah, and of course, we got to talk about the man under the helmet.
Yes.
Old Pedro Pascal.
Pedro Pascal.
Who, man, he seems like an awesome dude, too. I haven't really seen him in interviews much or anything.
Nope. Mm-hmm.
But he just, like you said, that just, for some hit me when he was doing the ADR stuff and holding the pillow.
Yes.
And I don't know why. It was just, you could just tell that he's like, this is great.
I'm having so much fun.
I'm having so much fun right now. Him and Dave Filoni and Jon Favreau all in that room together just going over the lines and stuff.
Although, I will say, if you put me in that room with that vocal effect of the Mandalorian under his helmet in front of that microphone, I'd be there for 4 hours just reading, like, the baby stage with me. No, this is not how it goes down. I'm gonna kill you and your friend. Like, I do that all day long.
But they were talking about, and he was talking about how, and I don't know if it was Deborah Cho herself that figured it out, because she talked about it,
mm-hmm.
but also Pedro Pascal talked about how they realized that his movements had to be, the performance came through stillness.
Yes.
Because the
it
more...
It was Deborah, yeah.
Yeah, the more still he stayed, that made every move that he actually did make become noticeable.
Yeah, more meaningful and deliberate.
And I'm like, wow. I mean, I love this inside baseball stuff because you just get to see how professional these professionals are.
Exactly.
Because that's such a high-level thing to think about.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we can't see your face. We can't get expression out of you. How do we get expression out of you? And it's like, don't move unless you need to move.
Exactly.
And it comes through, and he did such a good job. The funny thing, too, is we didn't realize there was three Mandalorians.
I was going to say, yeah, there's three people behind it.
So you have, like, Pedro Pascal for the acting stuff. And then I didn't write down the other guy's names. I apologize, fellas. You guys are awesome. But they have, like, the fighting guy, the guy who's, like, kind of MMA background. And
jiu-jitsu and stuff like that.
Jiu-jitsu and stuff like that. And then they have, like, the good old-fashioned fall guy.
The weapon slinger,
you know. Yeah, they have like, a gun guy.
Mm-hmm.
A fighty guy, and then an acty guy.
An acty guy.
So the gun guy thing was interesting to me, though, because I was just, you wouldn't think that would matter that much. But the fact that they did that shows that that did matter to them. Because the thing, they're like, we want someone who looks like they can handle a weapon.
Yes.
So let's get someone who can handle a weapon versus just like, well, let's train Pedro Pascal to handle a weapon, which is, I guess, usually what they do because you have to see the person.
And it probably would have at least met the bar for, like, okay,
right?
You know?
But they're like, well, you can't see Pedro anyway, so let's go ahead and get a guy who... Because I understand the regular fighting guy.
Yes.
So, and, you know, and technically he isn't just a fall guy because usually the fall guy is a guy who, like, oh, I know how to throw these haymakers and fall off of buildings into things. But they're like, they got a guy who's like, MMA trained, basically.
Oh, 100%.
So, which you kind of have to if you're fighting alongside Gina Carano.
If this is the way.
Because you have to because she's going to, like, expose it. Because, like I said, there's that story where she was like, oh, the fighting guy's like, okay, do this and this and that. And she's like, and he's like, well, what would you do? This and this and this? And they're like, oh, that's better.
There you go. Hey.
And then it didn't come up in this. Hopefully it will come up in later episodes. This is something I read elsewhere that they're kind of like, okay, this is an actress, so we have to go easy on her.
Yes.
And then they started tangling with her, and they're like, oh, wait.
She knows this game. They didn't hint to that story, but they did hint to one thing with Gina Carano where she was saying, like, there was a scene where she has to pick up the Mandalorian and drag him back into the shelter.
Yes.
And she just did it. Like, it wasn't a stunt double. She's like, I'm going to manhandle this dude.
Yes.
Pick him up. Let's go. And she could do
it. Yes, they did. They were like, what just happened? I love that woman.
Absolutely great.
I also like how they were talking about how when they're in the volume and they're doing the scene where it was the lava, the boat on the lava, and she's like, it was like the floor is lava.
I might get motion sick. Like, that's so real.
Yeah, I was like, motion sick. I was worried.
But then Kara Weathers steps in and is like, I would have taken care of you. It's like, I believe you, Kara Weathers. Good crew. With as far as the Mando and Pedro Pascal and his two stunt double buddies, just like there were three people under there. One you couldn't tell. So props to them that I couldn't pick out.
I couldn't tell either.
It just looked like
the
same character.
They said that they had a hard time telling. One of them said the only reason he knew is because he knew who would have been used in what scene.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, oh, it's a fighting scene, so it must be this guy.
Yeah.
But even then, it's sort of a coin toss, I guess. But it goes to show, like, they really could have just hired anybody to be under that helmet because you never really see his face. So the fact that for, like, the non-fighting and non-gunslinger scenes, they actually had a professional, high-caliber actor is just shows the quality of the production that they're doing.
So much.
I can't imagine having, like, every actor you read about in Hollywood's like, I don't want to wear a mask because I want to show my face. You know, I want to be on the poster. Like, you hear those Will Smith stories or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It is the drawback of the superhero movies. Like, do I have to wear a mask? Do I have to cover up my beauty, like what I'm recognized for? But
the moneymaker.
Yeah, the moneymaker. There you go. But Pedro Pascal's like, nah, let's do it. Put me in a helmet, put me in full armor, let's get it done. And they absolutely did.
That's the power of Star Wars, though, right?
Ooh, it's wonderful.
It's the power of Star Wars.
The magic thing about this Disney Gallery series is you get to see all the nerds and people that have such a passion for what they're making, whether it's the cast or the production or the special effects crew, everybody's on board. Everybody's like, let's make something spectacular.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Well said. And we're a couple of nerds trying to make something, too.
Yes.
So if you like what you hear, if you want to talk to us about The Mandalorian,
yes.
If you want to talk to us about anything nerdy, mm-hmm. we will respond to you. Hit us up at AssumingPod. We're on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. I'd recommend going to Instagram because Twitter is a cesspool right now. And Facebook isn't far. It's like a cesspool for older people.
Twitter's like the Wild Wild West. It's like Red Dead of online. It's pretty hilarious. It's
kind
of
crazy. Instagram is pretty nice still, yes. though. So, anywho. But,
wherever you find us, come and chat with us.
We want to thank you guys so much for listening. We got to thank everyone who helps us out with this podcast. That guy, Brad, for doing our announcing. Not Scott Productions for our equipment. Jazzar for doing our music. And I'm excited to see what the next two episodes are going to be about.
There's still two more episodes of the Disney Gallery to go.
I hope there's a fighting one and the story comes out where Gina Carano was like manhandling stunt guys and they're like, oh, like because the whole thing where you were talking about how like Michelle Rodriguez, as tough as she is, she's an actress.
Yep.
She doesn't have an MMA background. Not at all. Yep. So that's what stunt guys are used to. It's mm-hmm. like, okay, I respect her. I know she worked out for this role, but I don't want to hurt the actress.
Oh, crap. She's picking me up and dragging me to the next set.
Oh, anyway.
I hope that one episode is her beating up baddies, and I hope we get one episode that just tells us, here's what's coming up in season two. Yes. I know it won't happen, but I hope they do, like, here's spoilers.
I think it might, because I saw a picture somewhere of Robert Rodriguez with the baby.
Oh, I hope we get some spoilers.
Yeah. All right, everybody. Thanks for listening. Stay safe out there. Listen at the end. We'll have a special message from a very tall, heavy-booted... friend of ours.
In heavy makeup, just like the practical effects we were talking about. It's great. This is the way.
This is the way.
The lesson I want you to learn is it doesn't matter what you look like. You can be tall or short, or fat or thin, or ugly, or handsome, like your father. You can be black or yellow or white. It doesn't matter. What does matter is the size of your heart and the strength of your character.